The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2022, Living Liberation, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, you can visit libraplanet.org/conference.
Hi, I'm Jose Gatica from Chile. I'm a web developer and musician. So this year I'm here as a room monitor presenting some talks. And today I want to present Clinton Ignatov. Hi, Clinton.
Hi, Jose.
Clinton will talk about the media ecology of source code access. Clinton is a user of free software for nearly 20 years. Since then, he has developed a strong interest in understanding the social project, the social impact of proprietary software through the depth readings of the work of Marshall McLuhan. So, Clinton, the room is yours. Welcome.
Thanks for having me here. I've been using GNU Linux as my primary operating system for 20 years, and I'm a big believer in free software. So it's my honor to be here today talking to the free software community to both introduce you to and invite you to a wonderful field called media ecology. So here's some photos from the last in-person conference of the Media Ecology Association back in Toronto in 2019 when I was in attendance. You can think of it this way. What environmental studies does to look at ecologies in nature, media ecology does for technology. It considers parts in relation to the totality of both space and throughout historical time. It's a very, media ecology focuses on broad overviews, cutting through the humanities and the sciences alike. And the term media doesn't just mean communications media either, like writing or the telegraph or radio or the internet. But for everything we make, going back to stone knives and bear skins and office furniture. So I'll reiterate, computers can be a medium when they're offline. And actually, I think we must understand computers as they are by themselves offline before we can even begin to sensibly talk about the internet or social media or the problems of today. We already heard 100 rabbits earlier today talking through this exactly when they take computers off the grid on their boat. In a 1988 presentation called A Vision of a New Age, Alan Kay from Xerox PARC called Online Services the Information Grid, which is layered atop the power grid and the communications grid. So going off the grid doesn't necessarily mean working without electricity, it can just mean using your computer offline. Looking at the computer itself as a medium is what I'd like the free software community to help me integrate into my field I'm coming from, media ecology. So let's forget the internet ever existed for this talk. All our media are extensions of our humanness out into the outer world. Marlene Stryker in yesterday's keynote cited Donna Haraway to this point. This idea of our inventions as extensions has a long history, even just in the field of computers. You'll find it in J.R. Lidlicker's famous 1960 essay on man-machine symbiosis. Computer programming was called logic amplification. Steve Jobs' term was a bicycle for the mind. Alan Kay said that the work at Xerox PARC transitioned the computer from being a logic amplifier to being a fantasy amplifier. These are all ways of saying computers are extensions of some aspect of our humanness, of our form, and they distort our embodied human scale. So I'll start by sharing and illustrating a little bit of media ecology through introducing you to the character of Marshall McLuhan. Well, he's the father of media ecology and really of all media studies. If every university has a media studies department on his account. So we'll do that. We'll look over the stack of personal computers from top to bottom. And finally, look about how media ecology and free software can collaborate and work together productively. Marshall McLuhan lived from 1911 to 1980. We use the word media the way we do because of him. That's why people talk about media at all. He used two terms, figure and ground. I took these from Gestalt psychology. And these two terms, this relation, is what makes media ecology an ecology, or a measure of parts of the whole, right? The from the singular thing to the entire total field, that relation is ecological. So McLuhan's ecological thinking began, this is interesting, while studying literary criticism and the forebears of literary criticism, the ancient classical trivium of dialectic rhetoric and grammar as wielded in medieval scriptural exegesis. Now, that's probably a really weird thing to say, but we're talking about, as I said, media ecology stretches throughout history, as well as the breadth and depth of our technologies around us today. He had two English doctorates, that's why he got all this from literary criticism, one from the University of Manitoba and one from Cambridge. So I'll try to make this point by focusing in on just one aspect of his early writing. McLuhan's 1947 essay, The Case of the Missing Anecdote, is a response to a now famous essay by art critic Harold Rosenberg titled The Herd of Independent Minds, which is still read today in many journalism schools. In The Herd of Independent Minds, Rosenberg observes how the new mass media of his day often led to the erasure of individual private memories people have of large events. An erasure by a collective cultural memory. So like after enough time has passed, people can forget their own memories of an experience, their personal opinion of something that happened from the time it was happening, and just be told by media what had happened and how they had felt about it. Their memories are rewritten retroactively by the collective experience they've been told to. Remember the day 5 years ago when this big event happened? Here's how you felt, right? This is the technological and the media milieu in which George Orwell was inspired to write 1984. Since the invention of a telegraph newspaper, this relation of the individual to media and to mass minds and the groupthinks has been a sociological issue. So in response to Rosenberg, McLuhan writes The Case of the Missing Anecdote. He said that the solution to the mass mind problem existed in the habits of novelists and poets. He said, journaled constantly. Each day they found words to capture and record and assemble their own private collection of perceptions. They recorded their day-to-day thoughts. They wrote down bits of conversation they overheard in public. They wrote down interesting metaphors that rose to their tongues when talking to friends and family and people at the bar and all those things. They turned their perceptions each day into living language. After years of doing this, an author or a poet, having written every single day and created new language, had an arsenal of material, of words to draw on to create poems and novels and stories, which were filled with the vibrancy of life. This is how the best novels and poems came to fruition. Writers write every single day, right? Anyway, back to the ecology, the parts and the whole, the figure and the ground. The relevant passage from this essay of McLuhan's reads, quote, "When the moment of revelation occurs, a drama is concluded in which there is an established ratio between the poet, the thing, and the larger reality that includes them both. Baudelaire knew that the significance of an experience, and this is the whole of the matter, does not reside in a poet, the thing, or the larger reality, but in the ratio between these three things. It is because of the enormous variety of ratios between writers, things, and general reality that abundantly spring from intelligent conversation that the recording of the best of such talk is the primary duty of writers. These records make permanently available to many potential writers one kind of nourishment without which they can never function, save in feeble isolation. So that's a lot of complicated words, but look at what he's saying there. It's that when you're writing a story, it's the relation between things, writers, and reality. Now, the Free Software Foundation knows the importance of words and using language properly. We say free software instead of open source. We say GNU Linux instead of Linux, or Libre instead of free. But language isn't just about technical terms and using the right words. It communicates things through proportions, through metaphors, which exclaim the bigness and the smallness relative to the human or to the writer, to our bodies, to our minds, right? We are embodied beings in this technological world. We're not talking about ratios between these three elements of a mathematical sort, but of a more intuitive emotional sort in relation to our human scale. The proportions and scope of our extensions in our world are measured against us. So anyway, that's what's going on in the 40s. That's the literary criticism half of where media ecology finds its roots. By the 50s, he adapts this into a broader media study, and we get the language he steals from Gestalt theory. Figure and ground, and the human becomes this implicit idea of who's perceiving and who lives in relation to the figure and ground. Now, Gestalt theory, you know, is that field of psychology with the two faces, or the two faces that form a vase. And so when you're looking at the faces, you don't see the vase. When you're looking at the vase, you don't see the faces, right? When you look at the figure, the ground is invisible, but you can make figure become ground, right? Flip around perceptually. So this is the foundation for how McLuhan tried to look at media and taught the world to look at media. In the 60s, he exploded in popularity. This English professor from the University of Toronto became world famous, like a rock star. He published award-winning books, toured the world giving talks and speeches, appeared on TV. He met John Lennon and Yoko Ono from the Beatles, and Timothy Leary, the LSD dude. He hung around Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau and advised him on his politics and his campaigning, all the stuff. He was on Woody Allen film, the David Cronenberg film Videodrome, has got a McLuhan character in it. Eventually, you know, this figure ground thing, he also adapts the burgeoning field of brain science into left brain, right brain stuff. Today with like Daniel Kahneman's fast thinking, slow thinking, got this same idea between how humans have these two perceptual faculties and how they work together. This is all the same thing being talked under many different languages. So that's one primary basis of media ecology. So I've talked a lot about that. Why does this matter to free software, to computers? We'll get there very shortly, but first we need to get into another very important topic relevant to the free software community, and that is 18th century handcrafted European furniture. I know that's why you're really here, right? This is important because, as I said, media ecology isn't about communications media. It's about everything. There are a great many things we can say about furniture that we can say about computers, and I'd like to illustrate the relevance of that. The next few slides you're going to see have images from Siegfried Gideon's book, Space, Time, and Architecture, and Mechanization Takes Command. What McLuhan was saying about poetry and literature in the 40s, Swiss art historian Siegfried Gideon was saying about poetry and literature, or he was saying it about buildings, cities, and machines. They had proportions relative to the human. As an art historian, and he was looking at how art and machines and everything since the Industrial Revolution changed the human perception and the human relation. This French ottoman is perfectly proportioned. The elegant forms of its wood, right? They're small, and yet they can carry the weight of several people sitting. It's well proportioned, like I was talking about. and you can see the frame and the cushion together. There's a bad guy in Gideon's writings, the upholsterer. Upholstery just means fabric or cloth used in furniture and interior decorating. By the 19th century, Europe was dominated by drapes, clouded in curtains, and smothered with pillows and cushions. The material forms of the furniture of the room, they were covered up until they were invisible. The ratios were way off. So you see here, the chair on the left is nice and balanced. You've got a nice balance between what you would feel when you sit in it and the form of it, the weight of it, how it would carry you, right? The soft and the hard. On the right, you don't know what that is. Is a spring going to poke out into your backside? It's unbalanced. Now, jump to America, completely different situation. They're not drowning in pillows and cushions. In fact, they're creating these machines. The patent office was founded in 1790 in America. Panos Alavropoulos earlier today was talking about the patent as the enabling discourse of an invention, right? So a patent is sort of like the source code of a mechanical device, like this chair. So this is a very strange thing, this object here, because no one had ever really seen a chair like this before. No European in the 18th century would put this in their parlor. A few years later, boom, we got Robert Fitz of Fitchburg, Massachusetts. He innovates on the patents. He gets this chair patented, right? You can see that there's a screw that you can turn to raise and lower it. There's a spring mechanism. It pivots backwards. And most importantly, it's called an office chair. So you can see the ecology of the chair because you know what sort of room this would be at home in. You wouldn't put this at your dinner table. You wouldn't put this in your parlor. You would put this in your office. So the appearance fits, right? The relation of the chair to the environment works. And then it just goes crazy from there. Look at this. What the hell is that, right? You couldn't sit in this chair by yourself. You need a second person just to adjust it to you, right? Its accordance to the human body comes from perception of the body as a machine. The human scale that's being met by this chair is geometrical, mathematical. It's body as engineering. Only a robot would put this in their home and robotize their guests in the process, right? This is what was going on in America while back in Europe. They were getting more and more furniture that had no form. You couldn't see what it was made of. It was clouded in cushions and pillows and patterns and symbols and rich and sensorily overwhelming, but just in the superficial sort of way. Like, this furniture is the sort of thing you would lounge in while doing opium or smoking hashish or something. You would lose your sense of time and space. You lose, right? But they were represented as the human scale of the mind without the body, the dreamer, discarnate, floating away from the here and now, right? If this surgical chair turned you into a robot, made you aware of every single joint in your body, then furniture like this leaves you like an angel leaving your body completely. It's like something from a Tim Burton movie, really. Like, here's some more wacky stuff going on in Europe. So this thing here on the left, this is a birdcage / goldfish bowl / flower pot. You've got some topless sphinxes here with flower pots on their head, right? Europeans are going crazy into the aesthetics and the symbolism, the piling on stuff. It's very kitchen overloaded, made no sense. You got this bedroom here with a pedestal going all the way up to the ceiling. What the heck is going on, right? They're burying themselves in superficialities and aesthetics, and the forms are completely wrong. So maybe you can see how this goes with computers, but we got one more example to go from Siegfried Gideon's books on art history to drive this home, and that's in the world of architecture. So these are neoclassical buildings. They look old, but they're probably built with modern construction techniques. Their traditional, timeless appearance is a facade. If you broke down their walls, you wouldn't find ancient materials. You would find modern materials covered up with a thin veneer of aesthetics. This was the style that was reigning in Europe during the 19th century. Until the 1889 Paris exhibition, made the radical decision to hire this guy, who's an engineer. He's not an architect, he's an engineer, who made railway bridges and aqueducts in the middle of nowhere. They hired this guy to design the central exhibit of the 1889 Paris exhibition. And his name was Gustave Eiffel. And few people, except mountain climbers maybe, were familiar with his work because, as I said, his work was done in the middle of nowhere. The things that Eiffel built were designed to connect one somewhere to another somewhere, while himself remaining in the middle of the boonies, in the middle of nowhere, right? Bridges across valleys and mountains. So they hired this guy to build a central exhibit to stick right in the middle of Paris in 1889. Like, look at this aqueduct. Does this scream French culture to you? Okay, well, actually, maybe it does. Okay, well, let me take that back. If you grew up in the 1800s, with this big hunk of scaffolding, this engineering project, this giant piece of iron scream French culture to you? Someone wanted to say, hey, we're going to take this aqueduct and we're going to stick it right in the middle of Paris. What would you say? Like, you'd freak out. And that's what people did. That's exactly what people did. And imagine you're a painter and you want to paint your beautiful city of Paris. This is what happened. You can't capture the proportions aesthetically in a whole. The ecology is shattered of people's perception of the city. As a painter, I can't even create a unified gestalt where this ugly piece of infrastructure fits in with the rest of my city. So it's like, of course, he does the upholstery thing. What if we hang some curtains? Yeah, let's hide let's stick some curtains on the side of the painting. No, it doesn't work. Artists took a long time to figure out how to stop burying the iron, the concrete, the glass of modern construction and build them. Oops, jumped ahead too far. And work them into the aesthetics. So here we have a bare iron staircase. Here we have iron spires. It took decades for people to stop trying to hide the iron and to show the iron. Likewise, here we go. Here we have a computer interface, the original Altair 8800, which is actually showing you what the computer is. When you look at the front panel of the Altair, you get this row of lights, which represents the 8 bits in RAM of a certain address that you toggled in with these switches. And so you can say, here's a, right, okay, I want the Intel 80 CPU to look at this address, and then chick, I want to jump to this address, chick, right? The programmer's imagination, there's a space inside the computer, a memory space, right, with addresses, and each byte has 8 bits, and so what you do is you fill the memory byte by byte with your program, and then when you run it with a switch here, the CPU jumps through the little obstacle course in the RAM, jumping around as you program it, kind of like a game piece in a game of snakes and ladders. Individual bytes were the figure in the ground of RAM. So whoever was using this interface, their perception, the figure of the code was in the ground of the hardware. They were touching the hardware at every level. There was no black box. You saw the whole thing right through the front. 8 toggles, 8 blinky lights, perfect input-output symmetry, right? There's nothing hidden inside this box. Now, of course, it's ugly as hell. If you brought this home as a teenager and you tried to use it, your mom would say, get that in the garage or the den or the bedroom, but get it out of the living room. Get it off my kitchen table. Come on, it's time for dinner, right? What do you mean you can't unplug it? Here, like, I just unplugged it. Here, go finish your program later. I made casserole, right? Like, think about trying to use a computer like this. Funny, it's also fun to note that the famous popular electronics magazine of 75 that announced the Altair also announced CCDs, or, you know, the invention of digital camera sensors. This is a pretty exciting issue. By the way, Microsoft gets huge selling a basic interpreter for the Altair. So now you need this piece of telecommunications equipment, a teletype. And now you can feed BASIC, written by Steve Allen and Bill Gates, through this thing here and load the RAM up 8 bytes at a time easily. And now you can communicate to your computer in English. The history of that started with Grace Hopper in the American Navy in the 50s, this idea of computer programming languages written in human intelligible language. It's like you're talking to a machine, right? Now you're still filling the RAM, but now you're writing in BASIC. So the figures of your interface are lines of code that are jumping around, you know, go to 10, go to 50, go to whatever. I think everyone here probably knows how BASIC works. But you're not working directly in the RAM with the instruction set of the Intel 8080 anymore. Now you're working in this abstract language. You're removed from the system. What we're doing is we're building up the computer stack. Now you're not working with the CPU. Now you're working in a BASIC interpreter environment, and your ground is this roll of paper or tractor-fed fan-folded printer paper or something, right? Now, I still don't want this in my living room. Let's just get that clear. So in the 60s, Ole Aundal and Kirsten Nygaard had invented object-oriented programming. The first object-oriented programming language was called Simula. And after a while, computers, you know, stopped being about writing lines of code and being objects, being full of objects, right? To the dialogue editor from a very early IDE for Windows. In object-oriented programming, now it's sort of like this abstract space. You're declaring things into existence. I declare this into existence. I declare an instance of that into existence. And they each have an agency working against each other. If you read Sherry Turkle's book, The Second Self, it was written throughout the 80s as she's analyzing school children learning the programming language Logo. She talks about how the user, or sorry, the programmer, is mirrored in the agency of the computer that they're programming. So when you were using the Altair, you were the CPU moving around in the space. When you were telling the CPU where to go in RAM with the Intel 8080 instruction set, you were that CPU. It was a part of you extended into the RAM, moving around. And likewise, you were the BASIC interpreter when you were jumping from line to line, debugging your BASIC program. With Logo programming, which has this little turtle that drives around on the floor, you know, rotate 90 degrees, draw a line, turn this, right? Kids were programming this, and they were the turtle. And as they wrote the code, they were using their bodies in an embodied sense to move around, right? So object-oriented program blows that up to a world full of different objects with their own agency, a very strange interface shift. Now, there's all these different ways in which people, programmers, were interfacing with computers, but they still weren't easy to use. Until, of course, Xerox develops the GUI and Apple adapts it for popular mass usage. Now you're not living in the RAM, you're not even living in object-oriented space, now you're living in a world of windows and cursors and whatnot. So to use a computer had nothing to do with understanding a computer. They're two completely different objects. Now, at least on the developer side, on the software creation side, in the Inside Macintosh book from 1985, the programming and the application design are all mixed together in one document. But by 1987, with the Apple Human Interface Guidelines, now the design book has got no programming in it. The act of designing the interface of the computer program has nothing to do with code. This is the break of user experience design or UI design or human interface design away from programming completely. They're two completely separate fields now. The user is just a mouse, dragging things, selecting words. So a lot of this, around this time in 88, Donald Moore. So I was just explaining how appearances are deceiving when the designers of our commodity products are designing a system image which doesn't match the actual function. IBM had copied Don Norman's ideas in their book, and Apple hired Don Norman for their interfaces in the 90s. So this one guy, designer Don Norman, dominated both the Mac side and the IBM Microsoft side of GUI design. So in the IBM's application interface design book here, we see some early multimedia controls with the cha-cha sequencer. It's kind of funny. And they also designed this really wild style of text selection called area selection, which I thought was hilarious, because why the hell would you want to select a swath of text right down the middle of your paragraph? Now, I recently remapped my window manager KWin to use a different key to drag windows around. So instead of pulling down Alt and dragging around my windows, I use the meta key. And I discovered while working on this presentation that when you hold down Alt in LibreOffice, you can actually select in area select, you can select swaths of text right down the middle of your document. I have no idea why you would want to do that, but it's a feature that was designed back in 1992 that still exists in free software to today, right? We're doing some archaeology here on obscure features that people don't even know exists in their software. So by 1995, like I said, Don Norman was hired to design the computer interfaces and to sort of get the modern desktop with localization, all these things. Now, right, like at this time, we've got everything that we have today. We've got F5 to refresh. We've got F1 for help. Everything, all the hotkeys that you know and love and used were set in stone at this time. But still computers were not easy enough to use. Don Norman writes a book called, He writes a book called, The Invisible Computer, which basically says, we don't want to see computers. People don't want computers, but they're too complicated. Even this is too complicated. Why isn't there a closed box here? Because it's a modal dialogue. Why is there, right? Like all these complications, computers are still too hard. We need to create single purpose computers, which of course we know here would be proprietary and locked down single purpose. Here's where free software was at the time of these discussions. Now, sure, if you're like me, when you look at this picture, you don't just see the high level interface. You're not only thinking, oh, look, it's the GIMP and it's still got the multi-window version but that's a nice color of teal or whatever. Because you're a free software user, you're aware of the history of the software. You're aware that it's using the GTK toolkit or that it's inaugurating the GTK toolkit. You're aware that it would have taken a long time to compile the software in 1997. You can feel how long it would have taken to develop this version of the GIMP. You can sort of like imagine the weight of the dependencies that it's pulling through. You feel the choice of CDE. I think this is CDE. Window manager. You can, right? There's all these levels to this picture that a free software user has a feeling of as a human that someone using proprietary software doesn't have, and that's because inside of a free software computer, it's the whole community is present inside the stack at every level to build it up, to build up this human relation. The community that is gathered here today at LibrePlanet 2022, sort of, they all play a role in controlling this one box that sits on my desk. I've got this box in my desk, and inside of it is a GNU Linux operating system. But what that really means is an entire, decades of tens of thousands of people have contributed parts to build my computer and make it work for me. Now, like, there's some video gamers out there who are in love with a particular game studio, and they love the designers, and they're always excited when the studio releases a new game, and they'll read the change logs and install patches, and then they'll mod the game. But that's all high-level environmental stuff. With the free software, what the GPL allows for is a right to get down to the very bottom of the stack, to know every level of the computer, especially the boring bits. And I hope that my little foray back through furniture and art demonstrates that when we perceive objects, even like computers or even chairs, we see the superficial appearance, but sometimes we also want to see the form, the underlying form. I mean, if you're going to have this in your house, you'd hang a little curtain around that to hide it because it's ugly. Now, back in Paris, the Eiffel Tower was very ugly. No one wanted to see that. No one wanted a big, ugly aqueduct in the middle of their nice European city. Likewise, no one wants source code on their desktop computer. You turn on a Linux box and it's scrolling pages and pages worth of terminal output as it boots up to tell you about the services starting up and whatnot. Canonical hides that stuff behind a nice boot splash, whereas technical people love to see that stuff because they love to watch their computer build its environment level by level by level. They want to see the kernel load. They want to see the hardware get initialized. The ratio between that exposure of the full computer stack and the aesthetics of creating the computer experience for the end user has to be reconciled together. We can't bury the computer behind easy-to-use aesthetics. At the same time, we can't overwhelm the users with too much stuff. Now, this slide here covers a lot of people. None of these people are involved in open or source or free software. This is Ted Hoff from Intel. This is Gary Kildall from Digital Rights Management, who created the first DOS for microcomputers. The story of the Amiga is an incredible story. What I'd like to propose is that looking at computers as aesthetic devices that exist in certain ratio to our world and that have a history going back decades, that's the proper starting point for discussion about free software. You can't, for instance, last session, William Liggett from the Free Software Foundation was talking about how hard it is to explain these concepts to regular folks. So you got to explain to them free software and why licensing is important. You got to explain to them patents. Well, a better way to do this is to explain the history of computers and to own it. The history of computers goes back a century. Or if you want to get to the history of calculation, it's all the history of math, going back, you know, through Newton and Cartesian space all the way to Euclid in ancient Greece, right? The story of everything that makes your computer work is actually an entirely human saga of ways that humans have manipulated their environments. And media ecology, as I was saying, was the field about examinations of the total environment of our human artifacts, the things we design. And so when you're telling the story of free software, what you can do is you can own the story in a truthful manner of all computers, including military computers, including proprietary computers, including the companies that no longer exist, including the visions of the future that existed. These are, this broader discussion can be held in the humanities. And when people love stories, they love stories about humans. And so the relation of the Bell Laboratory folks to the languages they're creating, the story of Gary Kildall in his basement planning CPM. He had two sawhorses with a table on it and reams of paper and a pencil behind his ear. And you can find videos of Scott Kildall, his son, going down in the basement as a little kid and watching his dad design what became the dominant operating system, MS-DOS, when it was copied by Seattle. You know the story. People don't know the story. And those stories, the story of proprietary software, of military software, of cybernetics in the 40s, those are necessary information for making the free software story human. And again, this is about computers, offline computers. When you're listening to the 100 Rabbits keynote earlier today, they're talking about getting off the grid, right? Well, having an offline computer with no network access is being off the grid. This is the, right, and those folks were working in assembly language and using 20-year-old computers on their boat. This is about the history of computers, the power of even old computers, getting a feel for that proportion, for that scale. Maybe I'll wrap it up here if there's any questions or whatnot. I'd like to invite you to my website, first of all, concernedmedicine.com, where I've got some links relevant to this video and lots of links to get into the field of media ecology, to which I invite you.
Well, Clinton, this was a very hard talk. not for you, not for your topic, but this is a quick travel through design humanity history. Yeah. From years ago, from centuries ago, to finally talk about computers, how computers shock the common person life, yeah, the common users, and how it its evolution through the last decades. Okay,
yeah.
So this is there is no question, but I share your website on IRC, so
okay,
don't worry for that. But some user says, thanks for bringing back some nice memories. And yes, the community is present in your mind when you use free software. It's more than just using it. It's being proud of using it and being able to improve it, of course. That's is about what you say through the source code of a little chair. So one user that came late to your talk said, can anyone explain it to me about what is he talking about?
In one sentence, ecology means the relation of one thing, in this case the computer, to the whole history of the world and everything else. And so I'm trying to take a very, very big picture to say, you tell the history of computers better when you put it in the history of everything else and how they relate. So I hope I illustrated all the possibilities for storytelling that we can use to enchant free software to be meaningful to people.
Yeah, well, one question will be the only question, okay? Is there much awareness of free software in media ecology?
No, they're all involved in open source software. With the presentation I went to had Mozilla as a keynote speaker. As we know, open source means, as a programmer, I'm free to copy and paste the code into my program. It's got nothing to do with the liberation of end users. In my experience, for the last 4 or 5 years involved in media ecology, they don't have a language yet or an appreciation yet of users who actually want to be liberated by understanding the medium and having the code. They are stuck in the short market-oriented idea of a computer is whatever Apple tells us it is, and social media is this new thing, and it's not connected to, you know, the virtual community in CompuServe back in 1993. It's not connected to Usenet. You can read about in netizens.com, right? They don't have a sense of history of the computer and how the past connects to the present. That's what I'd like Free Software Foundation to help me bring into media ecology.
Well, great. I check again your website, because that is a good way to understand what you say.
Join me at concernednetizen.com. That's concernednetizen.com.
Yeah. Thanks. Good job, Clinton.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you. Goodbye.
Bye.